one's personal articles of faith. Just a reminder, if you haven't had a chance to fill out a survey that are located outside the doors, if you could do that for our benefit in getting the symposiums together. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Through the mic? It sounds like I'm echoing a little bit. I'm probably just not standing close enough. Okay. Well, we have five panelists here today to talk on this topic. I'm really glad that they could come. We're going to go the order of in the program. We'll start with Marilyn Bushman Carleton, who is the author of Keeping Things Small and Cheatgrass. She's was the Utah Poet of the Year last year and is an artist in residence with the Utah Arts Council. We also have Julie Cummings, who is a counseling psychologist and psychotherapist in private practice. And Emily Burley, who's a project manager at Novell and a mom-to-be in September, which we're all very excited about. Kim Walters, who is has graduated with her bachelor's in social anthropology researching spirit possession, and she is currently pursuing a master's in plant genetics. And Ardell Broadbent, who describes herself as, and I can attest to this as I've been her roommate, a minimalist, an eco-feminist, and she's also going to be pursuing graduate studies in clinical psychology and is currently an editor. So we'll start with Marilyn, and we'll leave some time at the end for some questions. So we'll stop presenting at about, hopefully at about 10 to 11, or maybe push it to 5 to 11 so all of you can talk.
Thank you. I also would like to say that I am married and have five children, which is somewhat relative to why I think what I think, or why I believe what I believe. The mathematical genius Carl Friedrich Gauss once remarked, "I have been sure of my results for some time. What I don't know is how I shall arrive at them." I have listened to others' personal creeds. They made it sound easy. I have managed to narrow mine to four basic concepts that have not changed for as long as I can remember. How I arrive at them, though, continues to change as I accumulate new and various experience. I am at an age when my youngest child is worrying about being relieved of some of his hair, when retirement and downsizing are frequent topics at our house, at an age when simplicity and calm are more esteemed but increasingly vague. Some of my past grievances are vapors that only gently steam the windows, a result, I think, of learning that I have more control over my own daily existence than I'd once thought. First, and maybe most importantly, I believe in the presence of God. It is not particularly important to me whether God has a body, parts, and passions, not that I disbelieve that he does. Nor is it important to me whether there are three distinct beings included in the Godhead, nor the specifics of each. What is important is that I feel the presence of God in my life, a spiritual presence that is sometimes palpable, a parental presence who cares about me and others of his children, a presence who presides over and animates the natural world. I've always been fond of the idea that God is large enough to fill the whole universe, yet small enough to fit into a single heart. I think God is greater than our human comprehension. Second, I believe in worship. "If I love you," Goethe asks, "what does that matter to you? What difference does it matter that I feel God in my life? I confess it used to annoy me that God demands to be worshipped, but I begin to see this insistence not as egotistical or self-serving, but as a benefit to those who worship. It is a blessing to see, a further blessing to spend one's gratitude. I believe in group worship, in a community of common belief wherein we give and receive encouragement and concern. Especially, though, I embrace personal worship and the solitude it necessitates. I became a university student in midlife. In one of my first classes, an orientation exercise asked participants to rank lists of four things in order of personal importance. I confidently ranked aesthetics dead last every time, after responsibility, spirituality, even leisure, mostly because I thought then it was the right answer. Like many, I was thoroughly planted, watered, and fertilized in the Western Mormon American work ethic, which I still do believe in, by the way. But then I found poetry. I learned that a poet must stop, absorb a thing with all five senses in order to comprehend and find expression. She must meet the muse halfway. When asked how one of his new plays was faring on the London stage, Oscar Wilde replied, "The play is a great success, but the audience is a failure." Typical Oscar Wilde. I believe the created world is a success. It is up to the individual to receive it. Scripture says, "Be still and know that I am God." I require the catharsis that comes from worship. "My God, what a world," the writer Annie Dillard says. "There is no accounting for 1 second of it." "Beauty," she continues, "is not a hoax. It is real. I would never deny it. The appalling thing is that I forget it." The universe was not made in jest, but in solemn, incomprehensible earnest, by a power that is unfathomably secret and holy and fleet. There is nothing to be done about it but ignore it or see, unquote. From Thailand comes the wisdom, "Life is so short, we must move very slowly." And from the poet, Naomi Shihab Nye, "Everything is famous if you notice it." Third, I believe, to paraphrase the second article of faith in personal responsibility, that we will not only be punished for our sins, but rewarded for doing right and good. In other words, I believe in rules and rewards. I think we ultimately reap the harvest of both good and bad living. I sat through a Sunday school discussion where the subject was a man who had joined the church in his late years. Most of his life had been spent in sin and revelry. Some of the class members thought it not fair that he might make it to the celestial kingdom when he'd been able to live it up for most of his life. The long-suffering righteous, they argued, should be more sufficiently rewarded. With the teacher, I believe that the man had deprived himself of a lifetime of peace and contentment. I embrace the moral and ethical lifestyle advocated by the church. I agree with the poet Mary Oliver that eternity is not later or in any unfindable place. I believe we are responsible for sins of omission, things we could have done but didn't, both for ourselves and for others, that we will be accountable for what we could have become but didn't. By requiring personal individual responsibility, God gifts us with respect. To use an earthly analogy, he insists that we be grown-ups. He treats each human equally. This concept disallows blame. As I make my own choices and covenants, I reap my own rewards and punishments. If I choose to learn from mistakes, I benefit. If I don't, my progress slows. What I learn becomes part of my personal repertoire. What I don't learn doesn't. To quote Mary Oliver from her poem, The Book of Time, "What is my name? Oh, what is my name, that I may offer it back to the beautiful world?" Fourth, I believe in the virtues enumerated by Joseph Smith in the 13th article of faith. I believe they'll fall short personally in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all people. This is what I think it means to be temple worthy. What is the latter day or improved version of the golden rule? With Paul, I embrace hope and optimism, including the promise of a progressively better life as we improve in knowledge and experience. I have faith that significant associations will continue. I believe in seeking, and seeking is a working word, whatever is virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. What fits this criteria is not necessarily clear-cut. I belong to a writers group, most of whom are active LDS, and questions often arise, especially after someone has been to the temple, that sound something like this. Is it right to spend so much of our precious time writing? If so, should we not consecrate our talent to the church? Doesn't that mean, then, that we should write spiritual poetry? I feel that whatever is virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy is, quote, spiritual. Furthermore, I believe that the spiritual includes as well the sad, the difficult, the ugly, the cruel, the vital other half of God's plan. The late columnist Sidney Harris, in speaking of art, says, "It is not there primarily to make us feel good, to stuff us, or to cater to our sense of the familiar or comfortable. Its main function is to prompt us out of our intellectual and emotional ruts and get us to share in the artist's vision. God is the artist. His plan situates us outside Eden, where our experience includes the lovely and the unlovely. Nancy Mayers, a writer who happens to have multiple sclerosis, speaks from experience. To view your life as blessed does not require you to deny your pain. It simply demands a more complicated vision, one in which a condition or event is not either good or bad, but is, rather, both good and bad, not sequentially, but simultaneously. I believe we are participants in a test, one we can personally fail or pass, find joy in or not, experience God in or not. I am comforted by the concept that a more glorious power than I can comprehend presides over the world and cares if I make it.
First thing I'd better say is that I'm a humanist. I didn't know I was, but I have discovered it in the last few years just in getting into some, frankly, labeled humanistic ideas and realizing that these are the ideas I have had all my life. So, my creed is a list of beliefs that I think of as truths. I first encountered them in the church, although they can be found elsewhere. And they have been borne out by my life and professional experience. I have developed and translated them into psychotherapeutic principles that I use in one of the most spiritual parts of my life, my work as a psychotherapist. I also live by them in my personal journey through life. So I will list the church belief first, and then I will list my translation of it into psychotherapeutic language and also just general application to living. Number one, there are 14 of them, but they're brief. Human beings are literally, spiritually children of God. The psychotherapeutic application of that is human beings have an unlimited capacity for good and evil. They can and do learn and change by choosing to pursue either choice. So the change can be good or it can be destructive. Two, eternal progression is an eternal law. Growth, actualization of potential, development of new potential are necessary for health in human beings. If not channeled positively, growth will still occur, distorted and destructive. However, the natural course is positive toward health and creativity. Three, mortal life is an intensive learning experience. Psychotherapy is also essentially a learning process, learning to understand and value the self, learning better ways to relate to others, to work, to society, and perhaps to God. Four, a physical body is necessary for learning. The implication of that is that learning requires cognitive, physical, and emotional involvement. You can't just learn with your head. Five, free agency is necessary for learning. Volitional commitment, investment and engagement of the learner is essential. The learner must assume personal responsibility for their own behavior and life course for change to occur. Six, salvation, learning, or growth are also dependent on outside sources. Family, friends, teachers, leaders, and ultimately, I think, God and Christ. We are dependent on others initially for survival, but also for feedback to nourish our personality, self-concept, and our basic sense of worth. And we're dependent for opportunities to contribute to actualize our potential. We are also dependent on others for a workable picture of reality in which to operate. 7. Contrasts, including joy and suffering, are necessary for learning, for it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. All experiences, with their concomitant emotions and thoughts, including bad ones, are sources for understanding and recognizing what needs to be attended to or changed in behavior. 8. Moderation and balance are highly valued components of righteous living. Psychopathology has been defined by a wise psychologist as rigid, impoverished ways of solving problems, an inability to adapt to changing circumstances, a lack of openness to learning. 9. God's love is unconditional and respectful of human autonomy. His love is the model for the love we should develop toward our fellow beings. The love and respect we have for ourselves determines our love and respect for others and our relationship with and concept of God. On the other hand, our love and respect for ourselves is in turn determined by our relationship to others and to God. We are responsible for what we become, not our parents, not society, not God. We are. 10. Truth has priceless value and ultimate power. It is diligently to be sought, nurtured, and shared. Psychological healing and health occur only as the whole truth is discovered and acknowledged to oneself and to others. Shameful and painful realities about the self and one's life must be acknowledged, accepted, and forgiven, and given their true place alongside the joyful and loving realities. And sometimes we forget that part of it. Denial blocks learning and growth, and the human capacity for denial is infinite. 11. Repentance is essential to achieving exaltation. My understanding of repentance is that it is the recognition and acknowledgement of mistakes, sins if you will, and the resolve never to make them again. It also includes forgiveness. Therapy is often a repentance learning process, which must also include an understanding of why mistakes are made, what needs the destructive behavior meets, self-forgiveness, and a change of heart so that the desire or need to act harmfully is less or gone. 12. Faith is essential for eternal and mortal progress, and faith without works is dead. The first task of therapy is to activate hope that healing or change will occur. Therapy is not complete until behavior, internal or external, changes. The faith developed in therapy is in oneself, one's goodness, and ability to grow and heal. Out of that faith comes faith in others and the ability to love and be loved. 13. Human beings can receive guidance from spiritual sources. Resources for growth and healing, spiritual resources, exist inside human beings in our divine nature and kinship. Some of you heard me talk at length about that a few minutes ago. Therapy is successful when the healthy self, the source of the drive to grow and of righteous anger, when that drive is blocked to be found in everyone, when that healthy self is activated and strengthened, when troubled people can learn to recognize, trust, and be guided by that part of themselves and others. And 14. Human beings need to be committed to higher entities than just themselves, other human beings, worthy institutions, and holy principles. It is often the pain of the conflict between their own true and false principles, or between their own principles and pressures from outside, that brings people into therapy. So therapy often includes the discovery of a person's guiding values and the principles upon which they sense they must base a worthwhile life, and the activation and strengthening of their ability to live by those principles.
Before I ever heard about this panel, probably about a year and a half ago, I started thinking that I needed to write down and decide what my core beliefs were. And this was happening, I guess, because I started noticing that a lot of my friends and loved ones were kind of taking a different path with their belief system, and I was starting to feel like it was like a little bit of an epidemic, and I was feeling kind of insecure. And also some of the things that some of these people would talk about, I felt like they could kind of punch holes in some of what I considered to be things that I ought to believe in. I'm like, I need to step back and say, what is really the core of beliefs, that it doesn't matter what else is true or not true. If these are true, I'm set. I'm okay. So, but I guess I can call it personal creed now. I like that. I'll read them to you, and then I'll explain them. First of all, life continues after death. Second, relationships are the number one priority in life. And then God exists and he cares about me. God is fair. God's will and my will can be in line with each other. And one purpose of this life is to learn how to make good decisions for myself. I am the church. Faith is not volitional, but I should nurture whatever sprouts of faith and whatever spirituality I have. Creation is sacred, and you could kind of call this the ninth one. I don't know. Other than those things I've just said, everything else of my religious beliefs is details, and they could all go to the four winds, and it would be okay. So I'll tell you what I mean by those. Life continues after death. To me, I put that first, like way before anything about God, because if there were no afterlife, I wouldn't care about religion, basically. My biggest concern at one point was, what if there really is no afterlife and I don't get to live with the people that I love afterwards? You know, what's this? It made me feel like everything was really temporary and really scary. And my biggest spiritual experience that I've had was yearning to know that there was an afterlife and getting a positive response that there was. And so for me, that's the basis of my religious beliefs. Otherwise, religion would be just kind of an existential, let's talk about ways that we could have a nice life and be nice to each other and feel good about ourselves. It's not religion to me without the afterlife. Relationships are number one. Kind of goes with life continues after death. That's why I care about the afterlife, is I feel that my relationships with my friends and family are the most important thing. That's what makes it all worth it. And the promise of living together afterwards is the highest reward that God could offer to me. It also means all my important actions and decisions need to be centered around my relationships with my friends and family. And it also means in some more specific ways it kind of comes down to things like I feel like I need to record my life. I need to keep journals and photographs and video letters, things so that I can share my relationships with maybe my children, if my parents have passed away and I want them to be able to understand the love that we had. I need to create a shelter in my life for the ties of love that I have with my family and friends, and not overextend myself so that I can't spend time with those people that I love, since that's number one. Kind of goes along with the don't run faster than you have strength, but that's to me the reason why. God exists and he cares. I don't understand everything about God, but I believe he has a personality that I can live with. that's believing that he cares about me. That's why I would pray and expect a response. The afterlife experience came from wanting to know something really, really bad, and I felt like he answered me. God is fair. like my mom would always say, it'll all come out in the wash. That was like her, I think, the biggest religious statement that I remember her saying. she had lots of other more complex beliefs than that, but that was the one that stuck with me. I feel like that's the definition of God, is that he's good and fair. And kind of like Marilyn was saying, you know, whatever all the other details are about what God is, I don't really care, as long as he really is a fair person. And part of that, I guess a corollary kind of, is that heaven is a nice place. He says that it's a nice place and it's worth trying for. And I believe that. I believe that the things that he's telling me to do are for my own good, and he's not an unreasonable or vindictive or vengeful person. That's kind of, God is fair is like how I measure when people tell me something that's supposedly doctrine and I think it doesn't sit right with me. That's what I weigh it against, is God is fair. So if that makes me uncomfortable, okay, whatever. When I get up there, he'll explain it to me, or it won't be true or something. So kind of one of my examples with that is that when people tell me, well, when we get to heaven, we're all going to live in polygamy and that type of thing. I just say, okay, well, you know, maybe so, maybe not, but I don't think so because God is fair. So, but, you know, that's like my little thing I go through in my mind. God's will and my will can be in line with each other, and one purpose of this life is to learn how to make good decisions. It's really, this is a really important one to me, I guess. I think that my life so far hasn't been really radical. I mean, it's a little different than maybe some of the normal formulas. My husband and I, Nate, we've been married 8 years, and we're just starting to have kids now, and I'm having a good time with my career at Novell, and so that's a little bit different than some of the formulas you're given. I don't think I'm real doing anything really funky, but I do believe that God accepts a lot of variation from the lifestyle formula, and I think the big thing that he wants me to do is I have to figure out what I want, and then he will support me in doing that as long as it's a good thing. And kind of one example of, I think, where I feel like we got the message like that was when Nate and I were courting, and Nate was, we were, you know, just recently returned missionaries, and we were trying to do everything good. He went to the Lord in prayer and said, should I marry this person? And he said, I asked, and I felt like the only answer I got was, well, do you want to marry her? I mean, do you want to? And that was the only criterion, and I guess that means that it wasn't a bad idea to get married to me. Anybody else, you might have tried to talk him out of it. But he was just saying, is that what you want? If that's what you want, go for it. And I guess that's a little bit humanist, too. Some people say that human beings only want things that are natural or carnal, and you can't make good decisions by yourself. And I think the purpose is that God wants me to decide good things on my own and learn how to do that. And, of course, that's why he doesn't tell me what to do most of the time, and sometimes I hate that, but... I am the church is the next one. I say that a lot. I guess people who know me know that I say that. And what I mean by that is that my perspective, my opinions, my beliefs are just as valid as anyone else's. And I am the church community. I couldn't be excluded from it because I am the church just like anybody else. And I can make a call as to whether someone's teaching something that's not in line with gospel principles just as much as anybody else can. I guess another way of saying that is I feel that I'm an no one could, you know, put me out of it and say, you don't know, you're not the church, because I am. faith is not volitional. This is sort of like the whole thing of why I wanted to have a core beliefs written down is because a lot of people I know, they're somewhere along the spectrum of agnostic or atheist, or maybe they believe in God, but they don't believe in the church. And that was becoming a big element in my life, like a big theme, and I needed to know how did I feel about that. I believe that God does not condemn people for believing or not believing. That's not the question. He wants to know, how are you behaving? And I guess the reason why I say that is I think that faith and testimony are a gift of the Spirit. And if you don't have those testimony feelings, I feel fortunate that I do, but I know some people don't, and I also happen to know from personal experience that it's not because necessarily they're sinners or any of those type of things. They may just not have that feeling of assurance, and maybe they never will have it. So I guess what I feel is important is that you be on your best behavior no matter what your beliefs are about a higher power, and that I feel like I need to nurture my own spiritual feelings and take good care of those testimony feelings that I have, because I'm fortunate to have them. And for others, I guess I would just say, nurture your spirituality, whatever that is, so you don't get hard and sour, whether you believe that God is a part of that or not. The last one is really new, kind of a budding principle, so I don't know that I have a lot to say about it, but creation is sacred. I guess that's my one principle where I kind of am turning a little more outward, that I believe that I need to take good care of the earth. I'm not sure I'm there yet or exactly how to do that, but I'm becoming aware that I feel that that's important. Like I say, the rest is just details. Thanks.
I think it's really kind of you to show interest in something so potentially self-indulgent as a discussion of one's personal creed, and it makes me sort of nervous in a way that you would all show up for this. My creed is singular and simple. I desire exaltation. This sums up the hopeful, jiggling existence that I lead. And so I've entitled my talk based on creedal points that inform this desire. My pursuit of godliness scrunched down into little one-liners. Number one, the sky is blue, the church is true. Certainly the church organization is a heaving mass of evolving discrepancies. But whenever that point is made to me, both rightfully and justifiably, my one response is simply, I know how I feel when I'm sitting in the celestial room, and nothing can change that fact. Mormonism is the path God has placed me on to search him out and become like him. That I can't deny. I know it in my stomach and my chest, and it defines my reality. Number two, I don't and can't know the reality of others. I can sincerely say that for myself, Mormonism is the community that God has given me in which to grow more like him. But I believe that others obtain increased holiness and become more godlike through non-Mormon yet God-given pursuits. For example, I know a few Hindus who are much more like God than I will ever be in this lifetime. As it says in 2 Nephi 29, God brings his word to all nations, and he commands all men and will judge them out of the books that they've been given. And I can't say that everyone has to be Mormon, although I can say that I have to be Mormon. So again, my fundamental axes, is that Mormonism is God's path towards Godhood. I don't know if there are other paths. I can only live true to what God has revealed to me, including missionary work, paradoxically. That brings me along. These next points are the things which bring me along the path of godliness. Number one, order and discipline. Order and discipline in my surroundings, in my use of time, in my use of my body and my words. I find that the more order and discipline I create or participate in, the closer I am to God, the more I can feel his presence. This is why hearing or singing in a truly excellent choir is the exultant experience that it is. Which leads me to my next point, that progression towards Godhood happens in the creative, in the artistic. I am more realized, more in tune with my identity as a God in the making when I am making something myself. For example, when I write, be it poetry or journal entries or long emails, literary criticism, whatever it may be. I've also recently discovered, since Jane talked about my interesting switch from social anthropology to plant genetics, I've recently discovered that creativity is not simply found in the arts and humanities. Good science is creative, and our great scientific leaps forward were because of true scientific ingenuity. I've been astounded by the feats of human genius, human creativity in science. This is because I believe true artistry and creativity demand a deep awareness of and engagement with life, a broadening of scope and perspective, our expanding into God's expansiveness. Number three, my progress towards Godhood requires recognition and analysis, stemming from the aforesaid engagement with life. The opposite of progression is to allow our senses to be dulled to the point of apathy, the blobs of imbibing flesh that consumerism makes of humans, homogeneous, actionless, uncaring, unaware of anything but personal gratification, the culture of pleasure and recreation, apathetic to the world around us. This is the antithesis of godliness. God demands careful and deliberate living. He demands that we come to a perception of good and evil and that we choose good. This necessitates recognition and analysis of all that we encounter. It demands deep thought, personal struggle, sacrifice, and a joy that consumer living robs us of. We can't let ourselves get so distracted that we are no longer concerned with that pathway to Godhood. Four, my progression towards Godhood requires participation in the church. Though for me a largely inexplicable phenomenon, there is something about deciding to stay all the way through Relief Society and doing my visiting teaching. Maybe it's simply a matter of integrity, of keeping my end of the bargain, but there is for me an opening of my spiritual senses that I never quite anticipate, which comes upon me when I give myself over to participation in the church community. I gain a peace of mind and a sensitivity to the Spirit that from fulfilling my obligations as a member that are lacking when I choose to cut corners or completely neglect my full activity in the church. I can feel a spiritual difference, and I cannot explain that. And five, most importantly, and Emily made this point as well, godliness is found in human relations, community above individualism. Godliness comes in our relations with every person whom we encounter. Relationships bring us the greatest possible joy. There are definitely other joys, but none are so filling. Seeking to forward these relationships before the seeking to forward the perfecting of oneself is where true happiness lies, e.g., being gracious, patient, and forgiving bring one nearer to God than being punctual, physically fit, and well-read. These play out at the macro level as well. Individualism should be championed only at the extent to which it does not endue community. Capitalism, social Darwinism, does not bring one godliness. Taking care of oneself is less godly than taking care of others. Greater happiness lies in the development of relationships than in the pursuit of self-betterment. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And what more godlike quality exists than pure love? Thank you.
I like the connectedness in this group of panelists. I've noticed that, both Emily and Julie describe themselves as feminists. Kim and Emily and I have all been friends for quite a while. And and Marilyn and Kim both work on cheatgrass, or write on cheatgrass. Julie Cummings and I have the connection of the same field of psychology, and Marilyn's book, Keeping Things Small, matches my introduction as a minimalist. So I like this. I feel like we're a cohesive group. Originally, I had prepared to speak on a panel for ecological ties to Mormonism, but that panel was canceled. Initially, I was excited about this topic also, but every time I tried to condense my beliefs into a handful of creeds, it just seemed to leave out so much. I believe in the Articles of Faith as a creed, the Word of Wisdom as a creed, the Ten Commandments, Chieko Okazaki's list of her certificate for the right to play. I believe in mercy. I believe in the U.S. Bill of Rights. I toe the Green Party line as a creed. I also believe numerous little quotes from unrelated sources, including fortune cookies. But if all truth can be circumcised into... Oh, no, I can't believe that. Okay, you know, there's this this Richard Lederer's book called Anguished English, and he had in there one line that a grade school kid had written and said, Sir Francis Drake, circumcise the world in a 100-foot clipper. That was like the primo blooper. Well, I guess that was just about as bad. What I meant to say was that if all truth can be circumscribed into one great whole, I want to look at it as a whole and not dissect it into little pieces that leave out a lot of other pieces. The true, the good, and the beautiful, Plato believed they are united, and I suspect he was right. Still, just to complete this assignment, I decided to list the creeds that someone following me around all day, watching me, might list based on my observations, or observations of me. I can't say that these are my strongest beliefs, just maybe the most obvious by watching me. Number one, avoid UV rays at all cost, regardless of the extra heat of hat, gloves, and long-sleeved overshirt. Seek shade. Number two, work hard and make sure all time is used productively. But while you're at it, make sure you don't make any more money than you absolutely need to barely scrape by. Read while walking, while waiting in line, while riding elevators, etc. Listen to Spanish tapes while driving. Phone friends while sorting the recycling. Don't run an errand unless there are at least three errands in the same direction. Pretend to be practical just to get people off your back, but in reality be completely focused on esoteric aims. Number three, avoid plastic as if it were an allergen. Wood toothbrushes, steel containers to oust Tupperware, paper, CD cases, natural fabrics only, glass spray bottles, canvas backpack, bone and shell buttons, aluminum shampoo bottles, refuse styrofoam cups, be completely and unreasonably obsessive because plastic symbolizes everything hateful in American about American culture, which is the value of convenience over health and ecology, the value of novelty over durability and beauty. Number four, deviate from every norm. Hold fast to a wacky backward religion, that is Mormonism. Shop almost exclusively at thrift stores, though this has become trendy in some circles lately. Tell weird and improbable stories on occasion, especially at parties or family reunions, unless everyone else is. In that case, be proper. Number five, recycle obsessively. Bring napkins and chopsticks home from restaurants to put in the combustible trash bin. That is the receptacle of all non-recyclable combustibles. Remember that Brigham Young said, it will take generations to entirely eradicate the influences of deleterious substances. Close quote. This is continuing the quote. This must be done before we can attain our paradisiacal state. Close quote. Number six. Choose friends based on their lack of image management. That's the technical psychological term for being cool. Friends of whom a sibling once said, quote, Ardell's friends might be all nerds, but they sure stick up for each other, close quote. Forgive me if this statement of creeds has been less lofty than you might have expected, but if actions speak louder than words, then this is a real portrayal of my creeds. Thank you for your time. And one last creed. I, like Emily, believe that relationships are the most important focus of life, and I think I'd like to end on that note. Thank you.
Thanks to all of our panelists for briefly sharing some very wonderful nuggets of truth. And again, I lived with Ardell, and I know she very much practices everything that she just delineated to you. We have, luckily, a little bit of time. Is that right? Okay. For you to respond to that, ask questions, for the panelists themselves to perhaps respond to each other's creeds. If any of you have your own little list of personal articles of faith that you want to quickly share as well, that's fine. But let's have a little bit of open time for some of that as well.
Other than Emily, no one really stated if they had developed this just for this today's symposium, or it was something they've worked on quite a while. Unless maybe someone did and I missed it. And I just want to find out from the other folks if being asked to do this was something that prompted them to consider their beliefs, or if they had kind of formulated something in the past, maybe hadn't written it down.
Mine was written down probably, I don't know, close to 10 years ago, in response to an assignment in a group that I belong to. What I noticed when I prepared for today was that it hadn't changed. It's staying quite constant, but there's always a possibility.
As I mentioned, I thought this would be a lot easier than it was, but when you have to really think about it and write it down, it was much more difficult. I just wanted to comment about one of the comments that was made, you know, when forget the names now, Ardell was kind of grouping us all together. Probably the thing that I think defines myself the most is that I'm a feminist, and when I went to write down what I was thinking about, I realized how, I guess I'm just not a very political person, but I realized how much that fits in with my upbringing in the church. I was raised in a small Mormon town, and yet somehow I got out of that the importance of being who I am, which I that didn't come out as much as maybe it should have, but earlier I might have defined myself first and foremost as a feminist, and it didn't show up in my speech, which is kind of interesting.
I wrote these down specifically for this panel, but they are they're things that I think about and discuss a lot. So in a way, it's just sort of a collection of my general conversation, and there's nothing that I haven't said here a lot, or thought about a lot, or given in a church talk, or whatever. They're all very much parts of my daily existence.
Well, as I said, I was trying to do this assignment, it just became so difficult because I realized that I had so many, there were so many things I would need to include that it would take time, and so I just decided to limit it by looking at maybe the idiosyncratic obsessive things that I do. And yet I believe that creeds are important. I believe that at different periods of our lives we need and do focus on different creeds, and those become our way to progress in that period of time. So I do believe that they are important.
I guess I didn't say something because I did kind of feel like I was saying, you know, why did I come up with that, my personal creed? I really felt like for a little while, I never wrote it down, but I really thought about it, and I kind of crystallized it for the most part because I felt kind of like I was awash in a whole bunch of, you know, what do you believe, what do you don't believe, and if you don't believe this or that, are you in or out, or are you, you know, it was kind of a anchoring myself, and I really felt like I needed that. And now it's easier for me to handle when someone says to me, oh, by the way, you know, I'm not affiliated with the church anymore, or I don't know if I believe in God anymore, or stuff like that. I'm like, okay, it doesn't throw me like it used to.
Do any of you want to comment to each other on the
you're thinking of as you're listening to each other.
I was just going to say that when some of the things that were said about aesthetics, kind of using that word, I didn't really put that in mind, but I guess I really do think it's important to make your life be beautiful, and there's so it's not just like all drudgery. Yeah, maybe we need to have the work ethic and everything, but that maybe would be part of how I would describe the kind of shelter I want to have in my life, to create boundaries so that my relationships can be nurtured and we can really enjoy them. So I thought that the word aesthetics was kind of a good one.
I'd be interested in, as many as possible, responding to the question, does your creed influence who you are, or is it simply a description of who you are?
The question's been asked for all the panelists to explain if the creed... I'm sorry, how did you say it? Just blanking out.
In other words, if you just kind of
describe
how Bardell obviously did.
Yeah, describe who you are.
Decide who you are and have your ground, or as write it down the creed, will it change or influence who you are? Will you now try to live up to that?
Yeah, or does actually writing it down kind of create you in a sense, influence how you are?
A few years back, I wrote down a creed that I wanted to be, and it was essentially a description of Ardell, and and I found that I couldn't live up to it. So I wrote a creed wanting that to then influence who I was, and it didn't work. So this, what I've presented here is a description of my existence, a description of where I find myself rather than where I want to go towards. Well, I mean, it is where I want to go towards, of course, but... Yeah.
Do you think it will influence you in the future? That you've written it down, or do you think you will just go on being who you are?
I go on being who I am, I think, because it really is just a distillation of my core, and that it isn't likely to change anytime soon, though I really wish I was
Ardell.
I would just like to say one thing about that. I mentioned in mine that several years ago in college I was asked to rank different things, and I had put aesthetics last. And by writing that down, it made me stop to think that that isn't true. You know, so I think that it was very helpful in doing that. And just as Mormonism both influences us and we're influenced by it, I think, you know, what our creed is sort of the same thing, that it's kind of a chicken-egg sort of thing.
I think that right now my creed is probably pretty stable, and it's not pushing me in any direction or anything. But I, you know, as I'm sitting here and the baby's kicking me in the ribs, and I have to remember to have good posture, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna have a kid, and I'm kind of glad I wrote this down, because I want to be able to distill for that little person, you know, what do I think is the most important stuff about the church, and the rest of it you can kind of, you know, fudge or whatever. But so I think what's probably going to happen is when I start having kids and we start having conversations about these things, it's going to probably be kind of a different exercise than it was this time, writing it down just for me. And, you know, things that with my husband and I, our relationship is pretty stable. We kind of know what we think and we understand each other. When I have kids, I think it's going to be, I may have to add to it to try to explain why I say this or that when they come home from Sunday school and I go, oh, no. So it'll probably be more influential in the next few years.
My writing down my creed actually took 20 minutes. But so the actual writing isn't so significant, but it was a creed that I developed with my training. And the reason I could write it down as quickly as I could was because I had lived it, I had worked with it, and I had to think consciously about it in order to work with people. So it's very much my guide for not only the work I do, but how I live my life. And I refer back to it. I read it periodically just to keep some focus on things, and I guess also to enjoy what was a very enjoyable process of discovering that it was all there, and that it was a part of my life.
Well, I think that that's a question that could really go both ways. I mean, I think writing down your creed, especially if it's someone else gives you an assignment and you write it down, it could be something like, you know, the notes you take at school and then you never look at them again. But it could also...
You didn't do that in my class.
Probably. but I think that... To answer your question, honestly, I think that our creeds are something that just come out of us. I believe that, you know, I used to collect all kinds of, you know, anything that would come my way that I thought was important, I'd file it away, and I'd try to refer back to it, and I'd categorize it, and, you know, it just got to be too complicated. Now I just fly by the seat of my pants, and I just, you know, I keep there's that, the first of the great commandments and the second that is likened unto it, you know, just to love others. And I think that, you know, he said that on that hang all the law and the prophets, and I think that if I do have any one creed, it's that, because everything else that you ask yourself, oh, should I do this, should I do that in this particular situation, if you've got the right focus on and are honest with yourself about what will be the most loving thing to do in that situation, then it's all going to come out right. And even if it doesn't, it can be fixed.
Yeah, one more comment. I noticed that several of you described yourselves as feminist, and you know, I think of myself with a, you know, a feminist focus, but I notice in the creeds that it doesn't really come out as, you know, a specific item, you know, it's not itemized. And so I'd be interested in hearing about how you feel that influences your creed, and if you feel that feminism, you know, is able to be incorporated into, dealing with human beings, or if it has a specific focus, something like that.
I was thinking about, in my creed, I got to the end and writing it all down, and I was reading it over and trying to tell somebody about it, and I realized I didn't say anything about gender issues in there at all. And I think for me, the point of my life that I'm at right now is probably because it used to be a bigger deal for me to try to sort that out, but like my husband and I don't really have any gender role issues that we have to work out. And at my work, it's very equitable to everybody. Like, I don't feel like women's issues are even come up. It's great. So I think what's happened is it's kind of been dissipated into just sort of like be nice and be good to everybody and everybody be fair and stuff. So I think feminism, I think it's there, but it for me, it's just kind of faded because in my experience, it's starting to not be an issue, except for maybe some of the people that are loved ones of mine who I think have a big problem with maybe conflicting with themselves or their husband or things like that. But for me, it's almost like it's kind of not a big issue right now. I don't know.
I don't describe myself as a feminist. I said I was a humanist. I have a few feminist issues, like equality of opportunity and pay. But for me, the issue is equally difficult or important for men and women. Men are as bound by some stereotypes and expectations as women are. And so I'd like to work, you know, with human beings around human issues.
I kind of touched on this before, but basically feminism for me is believing that we're all, you know, children of God, and that we have to find out what our own strengths are and have the abilities to develop those strengths. And I think for myself, in beginning to find some of those things, it has brought a lot of calm, and not that it's less of an issue, but it's just brought some calm in my life.
there are probably as many different types of feminism as there are feminists, and I believe that there are some that conflict with the principles of the gospel and some that do not. I happen to feel more that my beliefs are in line with cultural feminism, which rather than believing that men and women should all have exactly equal roles and equal responsibilities, I believe that we do have different responsibilities, but that those responsibilities should be treated as equally important and respected.
Okay, thank you for that last comment. Thanks again to our panelists. I kind of strong-armed friends of mine who I wanted to hear from and learn from to come, and I appreciate their cooperation and lovely thoughts. So thanks again.